This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Mark Kermode, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
How are you?
I'm all right. How are you?
Yes, I'm okay.
Just going to move this over there.
You could have done that in the hours.
No, I couldn't,
that you've
because
been
I, no, no, because I was over there and then I put them on. It was the funny headphones that weren't doing the, you know.
Oh, you've got them.
No, time. I've now got. Yeah, I've got.
Oh, don't fight, you two. Come on, now.
Reviews to come of Pan's Labyrinth, though we already know what he thinks of that. Hollywood Land.
What do I already think of Pan's Labyrinth?
Well, you think it's a masterpiece and it's the movie of the year.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. So you don't need to do that. Santa Claus 3, The Escape Clause. My guess is that you laughed once.
You have to hold your breath until you get that particular.
Who's the star of that?
Tim Allen.
Is he funny?
No, he isn't, no.
He's not.
Well, he's funny in the voiceovers for Toy Story.
And, you know, he's Buzz Lightyear.
He's Buzz Lightyear, yeah. And Toy Story and Toy Story 2, he is funny in, but in the flesh it's a different thing.
Also Jackass, the second Jackass film. Are you a fan of that kind of thing, Jimmy?
I like a little bit of that, yeah. I mean, it's very sketchy. It's got no sort of narrative arc. It's not a proper film, is it? It's just sort of sketches. But it's very funny. It's a funny experience. Good to see with a bunch of people.
Jimmy's still here, because I wanted to get his opinion on the movie that's at number 2 at the moment, as it's something that we have discussed.
As predicted.
Anyway, at 10, this is the box office top 10 this week, Devil Wears Prada at 10.
Perfectly good run. Good teenage girls movie. Nothing to do with an attack on the fashion industry, which it isn't.
Breaking and Entering at 9.
You know, I want to like it more, but it does have shades of Truly Madly Hampstead about it, and there are some interesting things in the King's Cross architecture, but it has ambitions beyond what it can actually achieve.
Interesting things in the King's Cross architecture.
Yeah, because the whole thing is about the architecture of King's Cross and these people living side by side, different class structures, different, you know, immigrants, some people who grew up there, all that sort of stuff. And it has a very, very broad canvas, and it takes a lot of swipes at a lot of things, and it hits about, you know, half of them.
Okay, The Departed at 8.
Which is a partial return to form from Martin Scorsese, although we're still not back in the territory of Mean Streets, but I don't think we ever will be.
Open Season at 7.
All those usual Digimation jokes done all over again in a completely innocuous and forgettable fashion that reminds us that children's cinema really has taken a bit of a downward curve recently.
Barnyard at 6.
And even if they're standing upright, they don't have udders. I think we've covered this in some depth.
Saw 3 at 5.
I just don't understand the people being carried out of that film. If you go, I mean, Saw 3 is exactly what it is. It's not well put together. It has no wit or invention. It's got a lot of torture scenes, and some of them are quite well executed, no pun intended. But beyond that, it's just boring. I mean, that's the main problem with it is, I'm not being fair. I like horror films that are scary, but Saw 3 is just a bit tedious.
Do you like your horror films, Jimmy?
Oh, yeah, I love horror movies.
But when you get accounts of people, as we heard a couple of weeks ago, of people going to see Saw 3 and then fainting and being carried out by ambulance stuff.
Oh, sorry, what, when you believe PR Puff is what you're talking about there.
There was
Nonsense.
A guy, I think, from Norfolk Ambulance Service who had come on and said, we're fed up with being called to cinemas because this is not the best use of our time.
And he took the money from the PR. Because that goes back to the 50s. I remember someone reading a thing about a guy releasing movies in the 50s, and he would pay actresses to go into the cinema and faint.
I don't think there's any suggestion.
Which was brilliant.
Yeah. I don't think there's any suggestion that happened. It was just, I couldn't work out why, if you don't like horror movies, if you think you might faint at a particularly gruesome film, don't go and see Saw 3. It's not a surprise that it's got chains and blood and...
No, what is funny about it is the fact that it kind of lulls you into a semi-dreamlike state because it's quite dull. And occasionally those are the times at which one can be caught off guard by, you know, by the violence. But also, I think with any of these things, if you want to go and see a horror movie, go and see a good horror movie. Don't go and just see a bunch of scenes tied together which are just attempting. In fact, in many of the same ways as Jackass, which is an awful lot of people actually throwing up.
Okay,
it's sort of the same thing.
I want to get to the number 2 film. So Step Up's at 4.
Which I liked more than most people. I mean, yes, you know, it's Dirty Dancing, okay, only clean, but it's fine.
The Prestige at 3.
I liked it. It's a little bit like playing cinema Sudoku, but it's a smart, intelligent movie that's got a good performance by Michael Caine, of whom we have seen some of his best work recently. Now,
Borat is at number 2. Explain briefly, if you will, what your problem was with Borat.
Well, it's really interesting. I noticed from this piece in The Guardian today that, you know, I say it here and then it comes out there 2 weeks later. As I said at the time of Borat, I sat in a screening room with a bunch of people who were howling like hyenas. And I just didn't think it was funny. I wasn't offended by it. I just didn't think it was funny. From the following point of view, I thought that it was basically an English public school twit laughing at dimwit Americans, or a pastiche version of dimwit Americans, with a hint of misogyny and a really sort of smug anti-Americanism, which I don't like and I don't appreciate. I don't have a problem with it. It's absolutely fine. I'm not legal suits. I just didn't think it was funny. Now I see in this great big thing in The Guardian today, long piece by Joe Queenan, which basically says, yeah, basically, it's an English public school twit laughing at Americans and making misogyny. I thought, that's really odd. It's, you know, it's like broadcast news.
Jimmy, do you like Sacha Baron Cohen? Do you know him?
Yeah, I do. I know Sacha a tiny bit. I met him once or twice, and I know Dan Mazer pretty well, who's the guy that produces and writes and does a lot of the stuff with him. I thought it's an interesting movie because it's kind of about, and there's quite a lot written about this in America at the moment about comedy and about meta racism, and when you sort of Ricky Gervais does it a lot as well. He does sort of comedy about the awkwardness and those sort of situations that come up around sort of racial issues and people sort of not quite knowing what to say, and it's kind of interesting, and I think there's a huge amount of trust put in the audience when you make a film like that or do comedy like that, where you're sort of going, we trust that this works on two levels and that you're going to be laughing for the right reasons. I went to see it and I was very uncomfortable. There was almost like two laughter tracks when I went to see it in a cinema in Leeds. There was two laugh tracks. There was one sort of laugh track of people laughing at the people laughing at the racist jokes. And their kind of their stupidity and kind of, you know, we're all in on this kind of joke, and we're all in the gang, and we all know that this is wrong, and it's funny because it's wrong. And then there was another group of people just laughing at the racist jokes, and it's very difficult because you can't police why people are laughing at this kind of thing. Not that you, I don't know, it seems like a very sort of tender area.
But the greatest problem is to do with soft targets. I have no problem with the, you know, meta racism. I think the thing at the beginning, that actually the one trump card that it does have is the running of the Jew sequence, which is so audacious and so extraordinary that actually it does achieve a level of genuine, you know, satire, because it's so extraordinary. But what happens then is it very quickly settles down into the softest of targets. You know, a room full of American feminist academics, a rodeo full of redneck American southerners, a group of stupid drunk American frat boys, and Pamela Anderson. And I'm sorry, I mean, it's like Pamela Anderson's a dimwit. I mean, it's so lazy.
Did you not spend the whole time watching the movie as well, picking out, okay, what's a setup
that
and what isn't a setup?
That isn't, yeah.
So you went, okay, that's staged, they're in on it, they're actors, they're not. It was quite an interesting sort of game. I thought it was a very entertaining, you know, hour and a half to spend. It sort of wasn't cinema, but it was really kind of, I was very entertained for the hour and a half.
Well,
and there was like four or five laugh out loud funny moments, which is all I ever want from a comedy.
Sure, well, if I'd had four or five laugh out loud moments, I think I would have been worse. But I literally sat there just thinking, it's just me. I have arrived from Mars and I am the only person who does not find this funny. And I am both thrilled and slightly surprised to see that 2 weeks later, the backlash. Can I just say that I was lashing before the back was anywhere near us?
It seems weird that this is a mainstream, massively popular movie, because it is such an acquired taste.
But
that's a
marketing job. You know, you mentioned before about the marketing. What they have done is a brilliant marketing job. I mean, actually, if hats off to anyone, Borat has been marketed brilliantly. Everyone was told, if you don't like this, you're thick. I mean, that's the way it worked. And I think, actually, now, 2 weeks later, people are starting to go, hang on a minute, the Emperor has got no clothes on.
OK, we'll do some more conversation.
What was the number one movie?
Oh, it's like, sorry, Casino Royale.
Of course.
Jimmy, you've been very patient. Thank you for staying with us for an hour.
Hey, no problem at all.
And
I'm going to jump in the car now, listen to the traffic reports for the rest of the day.
And I hope you get
Don't
to
go on the M40. I believe it's very, very busy. It's basically logjam, the M40. Take the M1, would be my advice.
Jimmy's book is The Naked Jape, Uncovering the Hidden World of Jokes, and it's particularly splendid and exceptionally for a joke book, actually. They bear repetition, and you can tell them on Boxing Day and people will laugh. Jimmy, thanks very much indeed. Thanks for coming in. This is 5 Live. Casino Royale, then the box office number one. Obviously, as everyone knew it was going to be. Just one other aspect. And people, now they've actually seen James Bond, may wish to continue some of last week's conversations. One thing that we never quite got sorted, or I didn't understand, maybe it's just because I'm stupid, you don't have to agree with that statement, is very early on, two or three times, Bond picks up a phone and it says ellipsis.
Oh,
and it goes, oh, and you go, that's clearly going to be explained. That's clearly going to be the name of an organisation or of a character. And as far as I was concerned, that was never, ever explained.
I have to say that I know exactly what you're talking about, and I can't give you an answer to it.
Stop then.
No, I can give you an answer, but not the answer to that, which is that I tend to think that within Bond films, there's an awful lot of little details that I just go, never mind.
It wasn't a product. Maybe it's a product. Maybe there is going to be an ellipsis computer coming out soon, which they wanted to buy.
Well, but it must have been. It would be like a code name for some operation, and probably somebody at some point was wearing red. And I'm sure we'll now get a flood of emails.
If it was explained within the context of the movie, there's something that I missed, please feel free to correct.
I mean, that we both We both didn't know.
85058 mail at bbc.co.uk. Anyway, so there's all that stuff which you can go and see. This, however, is new.
I just will start and finish with Pan's Labyrinth. I know Guillermo was on...
He was on briefly, wasn't he, before he decided to go off and have a cup of tea.
He didn't decide to go and have a cup of tea. He was pulled off to another interview. But anyway, regardless of that...
He said he was going to stay.
He did try to stay. I don't want to waste time arguing about that. Anyway.
Move on.
Okay. It's absolutely wonderful. It is, for my money, the best film of the year. And I kind of feel so excited about it. I'm kind of having to take deep breaths to calm myself down. The story, as much as it can be explained, is that, you know, it's a dark fairy tale about choice set against the backdrop of 1944 fascist Spain. And the story is a young girl whose recently widowed mother marries a captain who is working in the for the Guardia Civil, for the Civil Guard, policing Maquis anti-fascist resistance in the wooded region of Spain. And she goes to live with him. And whilst the end of World War II and the dog end of the Spanish Civil War, which officially, you know, finished in 1939, is being played out, this young girl discovers a labyrinth. And in that labyrinth, she discovers a faun, not Pan. It's only called Pan's Labyrinth in the English title. The Spanish language title is the Faun's Labyrinth, who says that she is, or she may be, the missing princess of a lost world. And she has to go through a series of trials on a quest through the labyrinth in order to become the princess of this lost world. So two stories operating parallel. One of them about war, which is very tough, very brutal, very dark, very realist. The other about a young girl not escaping into a fancy world, but being enveloped by a fancy world, which is every bit as real as the real world. Now, the things you need to know are, if you saw The Devil's Backbone, which was set in 1939, it was very similar sort of idea in that it was a Spanish Civil War story, but it was also a ghost story. Guillermo describes this as the sister movie to that movie being this movie's brother. It is an extraordinary mix of realism and fabulous invention. It has a menagerie of monsters that are absolutely beautiful and yet, on the other hand, quite scary. It's a film about children, but it's not a kid's film. I mean, it's a 15 certificate, and I know some people actually find moments of it too tough, and that's perfectly fine. There are moments, particularly in the war scenes, in the scenes of the real world, in inverted commas, that are pretty hard going. But I just thought it was wonderful. I genuinely think it is the Citizen Kane of modern fantasy cinema. It's one of those things when the movie comes together and you just think, if I can just get one of these every 10 years, I can carry on being a critic and sitting through all the Santa Claus 3s and nothing matters. It's a film made absolutely on the director's own terms. He's a director who comes out of genre, so he understands fans, he understands the language of genre cinema, and yet he never patronizes, he never talks down to his audience. It's a film about redemption and sacrifice and faith and hope and things that are beyond life, and yet it's not about an escape into a fantasy world. And I really can't recommend it highly enough. I mean, literally, if you only go and see one film this year, well, firstly, what are you doing with your life? If you only go and see one film this year, you go and see Pan's Labyrinth. And believe me, it's I'm not overselling it. It is every bit as extraordinary as I'm saying. And every time I read a review that's kind of lukewarm, and there are some which are lukewarm, I just...
Some people who disagree with you.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying that it's a matter of agreement or disagreement. It is like... this is what the kind of level that it's with me now, with Pan's Labyrinth. It's kind of, either you think, yes, that is a Citizen Kane of fantasy cinema. As soon as anyone says, but, I just don't want to hear it anymore, because it's like looking at the Sistine Chapel and going, it's really good, you know, but I don't like the bit with the cherubs up there. Or looking at the Mona Lisa and saying, yeah, it's really nice, but with a wonky smile. It's no, and thrice or thrumpteenth time, no. It is just a masterpiece.
So it's up there with the Sistine Chapel.
It's up there with Citizen Kane. I mean, that's, as I said, the problem with most movies is they're not Citizen Kane. But this is. It's absolutely flawless. It's up, you know, in the same way as History of Violence was the best film of last year, premiered at Cannes and won no awards, this is the best film of this year, and I can't see it walking off with a number of awards, because people just actually don't give awards to genre cinema, basically because the people who give those awards are nitwits and fools. But it is... absolutely full-on best thing you will see this year. It's a transformative experience. It's a life-changing experience, and it's one of those, you know...
Okay, in what way has your life changed as a result of seeing the film then?
Because actually, funnily enough, when I went to see it, it was in that sort of period when we'd had a slew of kind of... Every now and then you get to the point of thinking, this is where cinema is. It's not going to move on further. And then you see Pan's Labyrinth and you go, no, it is going to move on further.
But how has it changed your life?
Because it made me, you know, happier and more positive about things.
Right, okay, that'll do. I understand. So it's just changed your mood, in other words.
Well,
so you could have had a beer? Or you could go see Pan's Labyrinth.
Yeah, you know, that's what should go on the poster. Pan's Labyrinth. Or you could have a beer. Simon Mayer, Radio 5.
Apparently,
do you think people said that to Michelangelo at the end of it? Do you think they said, it's really nice. Could have had a Swiftie, though, couldn't you?
Yeah, maybe. Could have taken that a number of ways. Apparently, ellipsis was the code for the keypad lock at the airport.
Oh, OK, fine. Didn't notice.
Threw that away, didn't they?
There we go. OK.
So if we don't want to go and see a movie that will change our life, just something that just might be, you know, well, mildly entertaining.
One thing that may is the Santa Claus 3, in that it is, you know, it is vile and hideous and just so bereft of any value whatsoever that it is one of those things that would turn you into the most incredible misanthrope. It's, I mean, I think the only way I can describe it is, you know, it's almost like tertiary syphilis, you know. It's like, no, seriously.
Put that
like,
on the poster.
Because what happens is, you know, you get the first thing and, you know, and you get rashes and then it goes away, and then you get the second one, you get really sick, and then it goes away, and then it goes, and you completely forget about it. Then many I used to work in hospital, and many, many years later, it recurs and it eats your wiring up from the inside and fries your brain, and you feel your soul. And honestly, sitting there watching Santa Claus 3 was just like being physically ill. It is so horrible and so disgustingly putrid. And the story is, you know the story of the original Santa Claus movie,
that
Tim Allen has to sign a contract and become Santa Claus. So it's like Miracle on 34th Street meets The Fly, and he becomes Santa Claus. And then in the next one, Mrs. Claus, he gets married. And then in this one, well, we got to get it out again. No, let's have Jack Frost. Jack Frost wants to become Santa Claus, and Santa Claus got a problem with the in-laws because it's Tim Allen. He used to do that thing, you know, good house, whatever it was called, you know, Man About the House. And not Man About the House. What was that thing? Home Improvement. Whatever that terrible sitcom he used to do.
Yes, it was Home Improvement.
Home Improvement. Did, yeah. And then so they have to bring the in-laws to the North Pole and tell them that all the elves are surrounded by are Canadians. And honestly, it's so, so horrible. And then at one moment, somebody actually says, this junk is not what Christmas is all about. And almost as one, you can feel everyone up in the again. Up in the room and going, exactly.
So when it comes up in a conversation in the next few weeks, you know, shall we go and see Santa Claus 3, The Escape Clause? What you need to say is, apparently it's like having tertiary syphilis.
Yeah, that is. I mean,
is there a way of saying that to a kid who might want to go? How would you say?
I think, no, the way of saying it to a kid is just no. No. It's like all the things that you don't do. You don't run with scissors. You don't run with a toothbrush and method. You don't go and see Santa Claus 3. Okay. And believe me, I'm really not exaggerating this. If you go and see it, you will feel like, you know that thing about that Nietzsche phrase, he who fights monsters should see that he does not become monstrous. And if you look long enough into the abyss also looks back into you. Watching Santa Claus 3 is like the abyss looking back into you and sucking your life force out through your ears.
It changes your life.
Well, yeah. Hollywoodland, however, Ben Affleck, who has not had a good time recently, semi back on form. The story is based on the true story of George Reeves, who was an actor who's most famous, or infamous perhaps, for playing Superman and the television series of Superman. And when George Reeves died in the 1950s, it was a suicide, at least that was how it was recorded. The theory of the movie is that, well, perhaps something else happened. Perhaps there were other circumstances that conspired around George Reeves' death. And it features an extraordinary central performance, extraordinary, bearing in mind just how naff he's been recently, by Ben Affleck, doing that most difficult of things, playing quite a bad actor. A lot of people have said about Hollywoodland that it's not LA Confidential, and it isn't LA Confidential. Actually, the thing it's most reminiscent of is that Atomic Goyen film, which I rather like, Where the Truth Lies. It's visually very, very rich. It has, as a sort of central MacGuffin, Adrian Brody as a detective.
How do you define MacGuffin, by the way?
The MacGuffin is the device that carries the plot forward. It's the thing which is not really what the film is about, but it's the thing that literally keeps the plot moving forward.
Thank you. Carry on.
Okay. I'm being very informative today, aren't I?
Yes, it's mildly entertaining.
Okay. And the story is that Adrian Brody is talking to all the people who knew George Reeves in his last years and going through all the different versions of what may have conspired to cause his death. There's a very good performance by Bob Hoskins, who finally appears to have mastered American accent, which he's been quite bad at in the past. I mean, you remember in Who Framed Roger Rabbit, when it's really very, very uncertain what planet Bob is from, but he's got it together here. And an absolutely stand-up performance by Diane Lane, who I think is a really good actress, was very good in that Adrian Lyne film, Unfaithful, which is a remake of a French film, and it's her and Richard Gere, and actually a dynamite combination for me because I like it on all fronts, Diane Lane and Richard Gere together at last. And in this, she's really good. It is slightly long. I mean, 126 minutes, it takes its time, and I think some people would find it perhaps not ripping enough. It's not enough, you know, massive movement of character, but it's a mood piece. It's nostalgic mood piece. Adrian Brody seems to annoy some people. I think he's quite an interesting, fragile screen presence. I don't think he's a brilliant actor, but I think...
He always reminds me of Alistair McGowan. And I think as soon as he comes around, I think, oh, it's Alistair McGowan again. What's he doing? What's he doing climbing up skyscrapers in New York?
Well, he's not the guy playing George Reeves.
Well, so that's okay then.
Yeah, no, the guy playing George Reeves, as I think I covered in some depth, is Ben Affleck.
Oh, no, I realise that. Okay. It's just whatever role he's playing.
Oh, you mean whatever he's doing, yeah. He looks like... Okay,
it's like when he's in King Kong, that's what he's doing.
Okay, well, that may be a problem. But in this, that for me, that wasn't a problem. And I like Hollywood Land. I thought it was moody and interesting. Okay, also out this week, I'm trying to rump through stuff because we had a slightly compressed time. Okay, Leonard Cohen, I'm Your Man, which is a documentary about Leonard Cohen wrapped round a concert, a tribute concert to Leonard Cohen. Now, I was under the impression that you're a big Leonard Cohen fan.
I quite like some of his stuff, which doesn't really has me down as a huge fan. No.
Oh, okay, fine. So, but you think some of it's okay?
Yeah, some of it's all right.
You know, arch miserabilist and known for...
That was closer to Tom Waits, really.
Well, God bless you for saying that I sounded like Tom Waits. That's set me up. That's a life-changing moment for me.
Closer to Tom Waits than Leonard Cohen.
Okay, fine.
Proceed.
So what we get is a number of people doing Leonard Cohen songs on stage, interspersed with interviews with Leonard Cohen. Now, I think Leonard Cohen's an interesting enough guy. I mean, he's not as interesting as Bob Dylan or whatever, but he's an interesting guy. However, I have to say that there are musical high and indeed low lights. I'm going to play you one of the low lights, which is your man there, Rufus Wainwright, who for me is America's answer to Tony Hadley. He is the singing foghorn, and everything he does sounds like the Manx Ferry docking.
You've lost the Tom Waits crown.
Fine. Well, you know, everybody knows that fantastic Leonard Cohen song, which I really love because it's used at the beginning and end of Exotica, the Atomic Goyen film, which I love to pieces, okay? And there are highs and lows, and it's a little bit reverential, but it's quite interesting. It's no more than quite interesting, but it's quite interesting. Also out this week on the musical documentary, or should that be rockumentary front, Tenacious D, The Pick of Destiny. Nick, thank you. Now, I was really looking forward to Tenacious D, The Pick of Destiny, because I like School of Rock, I like Jack Black. The story is, some of you may have seen the Tenacious D TV show, which I haven't seen before, but I've seen stuff of Tenacious D. It is a story of a rubbish band who are sort of a mixture between prog rock and, Led Zepp, but played on acoustic guitars. School of Rock works really well because he's doing all that stuff with kids. Therefore, you know, minimal swearing. I mean, no swearing. And the gag is that the kids are hipper than he is. The problem with Tenacious D, Pick of Destiny is, it's like, okay, gloves are off, not on television. We can do all the swearing and all the stuff that we want to do. And you know what? It's just not as funny. When you're just in the company of a couple of bozos who are behaving just like a couple of bozos, sort of doing sub-Blues Brothers-y, you know, story of the band getting themselves together on a quest. I mean, the deal is that they are looking for a pick, which is a pick, it's a bit of the devil's tooth that has been played by all the great rock gods. And there is one very funny speech in it in which, having lost the pick, somebody takes them aside and says, look, Satan doesn't exist in a pick. Satan's in all of us. Satan is the thing, and he does that kind of, you know, as if he was doing, but that's it. That's literally the height of the comedy. The rest of it is just two kind of fat beery blokes making fat beery jokes, which are not anything like as funny as they ought to be, and not anything like as funny as Jack Black can be when he is constrained, as he was in School of Rock, by having to make a PG-rated movie. My advice to him is, stop playing with the big boys and get back to playing with the school kids, because they were a great influence
on
you.
And is it the same character, essentially?
School of Rock?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, except that he's actually becoming a rock personage.
So, movie of the week?
Well, you know, movie of the year, Pan's Labyrinth. Please make it a hit. Please go and see it.
But it's quite close between that and Santa Claus 3.
The cinematic equivalent of tertiary.
I think you've made that point.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find out about other BBC podcasts, including the new Ashes Test Match Special podcast, go online bbc.co.uk/cricket.